Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Welcome to Experience Focused Leaders. I'm delighted to introduce you to Luke Tobin, a serial entrepreneur who's exited three companies, including Digital Ethos, the UK's fastest growing marketing agency, which is sold to Cadastra. As a co-CEO of Cadastra EMEA, Luke oversaw 900 employees and a $50 million in revenue portfolio, working with small clients like Samsung, Unilever, and the NHS. He now leads Tobin Capital, focused on scaling high potential companies, with a portfolio including well-known companies like SpaceX and Relate2. Welcome to the pod, Luke.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Alex. Good to be here.
Well, so many reasons to connect. We just love your insights in marketing, both in terms of running an agency and now supporting non-agency, highly scalable organizations. So perhaps let's start at the beginning. You've been running a marketing agency for quite some time.
Yes.
What did it take to succeed when you got started? And what do you see as the key to success now?
Okay. So I think, you know, agencies in general, marketing is a commodity driven space these days, right? You know, I think in the UK alone, 26,000 different agencies, I think globally, over 500,000 or something, which is, you know, just insane to think about the level of competition. So when I started, I'd worked in a few other agencies. I'd had, you know, exposure on client side and agency side to, I think, the kind of trappings of what did and didn't work. And I think, you know, you've probably experienced this, I'm sure some of the audience as well. There's almost like a no man's land that sits between the agency and the client. There's kind of this area of mistrust, like, you know, who's thinking what? Is the agency actually aligned to the expectations and the goals of the company? And I kind of, when I was in an agency just before I founded mine, I used to hate the fact that there wasn't really true alignment. It was more of like, okay, we need to bill as much as we can for as long as we can and deliver okay work. And I don't think it's the agency not wanting to do good work. It was just kind of a misalignment. So I started my agency with a kind of plan to bridge that gap, if you like. And the way that I approached that was very much around going in and actually becoming a kind of a real consultant for that business. So we would go and physically, when I started, it was just me. I would go and sit in the client's office for 2-3 days at a time. I think the longest was 2 weeks. You ask all the questions that you'd ask if you're a new employee, and you really integrate into the business. And even to this day, Alex, I don't think there's many agencies that are doing this deeply integrated model. There's a lot of agencies that say we're an integrated agency, but actually truly going and like investing that time up front to understand what those kind of short, mid, long-term goals are. And that really set us up into in a commodity-driven space, we carved out something that was quite unique really quickly. And effectively we're able to scale. Oh, you're muted.
Yeah. If you're in a commodity, then the relationship is the key.
It's the key. It's the thing that sets you apart. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Definitely.
And so you, and also life is more fun when you have deeper relationships with your clients, I would imagine.
So much better. And you know, marketing is one of those things, and we all know this, where things do go wrong, right? You could have the best campaign strategy in the world. You deploy it, and for whatever reason, it just might not work. Might be the wrong timing. The channels might be wrong. You know, whatever. Budget might not be enough. There's all sorts of things that can happen. And if you've got that relationship and you've gone and spent that time, and, you know, arguably you've done all of the personal bits in and around that, you get a little bit more rope from the client to try new things, test things. Look, this hasn't worked. let's have a bit longer. So what we found was, you know, even where we didn't nail the campaign straight away, the clients wouldn't churn. Whereas typically in an agency relationship, once there's a burn, you know, in the first 6 months, it's over, it's done, you know. And I think the average turnover rate in agencies in the UK is about 40% year on year. So you're having to win all those new clients constantly. And we avoided that. You know, our retention rate was 95% in the first 5 years. So we were just growing, whilst everyone else was kind of churning clients. So that was the real point of difference, I think, that set us up for the success that we saw.
Amazing. So when you build that relationship in the pre-COVID era, right, UK relatively concentrated, everybody could go meet somewhere in central London, oftentimes feels like, you know, you're doing a lot of things in person, right? Mm-hmm. Go to the pub at the end of the day and like also build that relationship.
Definitely, yeah.
Let's say COVID era, let's say your smaller agency, right, that maybe doesn't have ability to do that because it just doesn't scale the size of the projects. Mm-hmm. How do you build trust and relationships in a digital first, remote first universe?
It's tough, but it's not impossible. You know, with COVID, we had to pivot as well. And our strategy of going and sitting in the office wasn't a thing anymore for a couple of years. So I think just doing immersive workshop type sessions, you know, almost like kind of show and tell with the client as much as you can to really understand what makes them work. And I think be willing to have the tougher conversations. I think what agencies tend to do is shy away from, they'll just accept what the client's asking for, but shy away from those tough conversations. So like question why? And, you know, if the client gives you some KPIs, okay, why and what for and what's the benefit? And, you know, how realistic is it? And push back early on, because that just sets the right expectation for the long run. And I think there are still ways, and that tends to be.
So less British, more American. Is that your?
Be more American, yeah.
Great. I can run an agency in the UK now, finally.
Definitely right. Be more American. Yeah, no.
So I think, and as we joke, for those of you that are not in the familiar with the UK business culture, I think it's certainly in the England part of the United Kingdom, the confrontation is a bit frowned upon, right? And there's lots of ways to avoid embarrassment of a direct confrontation that you have to read between the signs, but it's still, and people do read, but it's not a direct read. So I think it's just too subtle. To actually make as much of an impact. Is that an accurate description, Luke?
It is. And I think also, you know, if you're trying to sell to someone in the UK, or certainly in England, you know, they often don't want to say no to you. So you can spend your time, you know, over and over chasing somebody. Okay, I'm still thinking about it, maybe, blah, blah, blah. In the end, if they haven't made a decision in a couple of weeks, it's probably a no. So just move on. But you know, again, it is that politeness. I think the British culture, we are overly polite and we don't like to offend. So instead, we'll avoid those difficult conversations, quite typically.
And then, like, I'm going to editorialize because I've ran an agency and we support a few agencies. It feels like there's some clients expect, at least when they're getting new business, they really expect agencies to do a bunch of free work. Mm-hmm. And I think that doubles down on the problem, right? Like you're busting your chops, trying to please somebody who's not going to say no. And for all intents and purposes, they may be just kind of keeping you along, or they're afraid of, like, maybe they're not that evil. They just are afraid of, like you said, afraid of having a harder conversation, but you end up as an agency, as individuals, wasting quite a lot of cycles. And we noticed this, interestingly, in Relate2 world, we noticed that people would be like submitting some kind of a leave behind or, you know, deliverables digitally. Mm. And verbally of your email, people would be like, oh, yeah, this is great. Keep it coming. You know, good job there. You attaboy. And then they wouldn't be looking at that stuff because we could capture the actual engagement data. So that was like, what's going on, right? Like people are basically wasting your cycles and making you spin and like work on some deadline on an RFP process that you're like not even column B, you're like column, you know, that you can't see in the spreadsheet type of person. So, and that felt tragic, actually, for a lot of these great creative businesses. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I mean, it's a challenge. And, you know, those RFP processes, just to touch on that to start with, being client side and running a few of them before, quite often you do it just to get fresh ideas, right? Yes, you're probably going to give some work to somebody, but some of them are a bit of a ruse. You know, they're ran and actually, you know, they already have the agency they're going to go with, but they want some ideas from 10 other companies, and agencies pour their heart and souls and hours into these things. So it is soul destroying. And I think there's also this kind of bit that you touched on at the start there around some clients realize that if you jump up and down and shout the loudest, you probably get more. And then that makes it, because again, people are polite in the agency and they want to do well and they want to please the clients, they will jump up and down and do all that extra work. So it's tricky. That part of it is really, really challenging. And the only way to deal with it is to have quite a strict process. But then the caveat to that can affect relationship, right? So
yeah.
But the
relationship goes both ways, right? Like, so, and I think one of the things we've noticed is from agency folks that if the client is asking, I need this deliverable on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And then you basically ruin the weekend. You work through, you know, like to get this done, mm-hmm. send the deliverable, you feel good about yourself. And then the analytics data shows that they didn't look at it. And that's like, and that's interesting, right? And that holds some accountability both ways, actually, in a good way, because it basically means, hey, these people, they're creative, you know, great human beings. They got lives. They're not just there to serve you. Like, you need to build a trusted mutual relationship. And I think that's just a better foundation for life, right? And you know, maybe you need to fire some clients that are kind of abusive to you in that way, right? So I felt like this is not just for proposals. This could be even for delivery. Just some mutual accountability drives that better practices. What are your thoughts on that? Have you done anything like that, like fired clients and mm-hmm. and
I have.
How did that go?
I think, you know, if you notice on those analytics, that's a perfect example. I think you should be questioning that client straight away and say, we can see you've not opened it. You know, our team, and I would be happy to have that frank conversation, you know, probably not a typical Brit in that sense, you know, be like, look, I can see you didn't open it till Tuesday. Our team works over the weekend as promised. But yeah, I think, you know, the firing of clients, a lot of agency owners, especially till they get to a certain kind of cushion or size, find it really difficult to do. But what I found is that if you show the team that you're willing to make those tough decisions and sometimes sacrifice revenue mm-hmm. in exchange for their mental health and their kind of supporting them, they will work harder for you on the clients that actually are the ones that are probably going to drive performance. And the other thing that happens with those clients anyway that drive you into the ground, they end up becoming really unprofitable when you work on a kind of hour cost basis. So letting them go is probably the best thing you can do, because I've seen it in a lot of agencies where you put all of your time and energy into that one or two clients that are jumping up and down and causing havoc. You drop the ball on a few others that are great clients, and in the end, they're the ones that churn. And you're like, hold on, now we're stuck with these bad apples when actually we have this, you know, basket of good ones. So, I think just always be willing to make those tough decisions, and you get the team loyalty as well.
Let's make this not as hypothetical, but a harder decision. Let's say that big annoying client is actually A, important in terms of revenue, but B, it's a great brand.
Yeah.
It's the, you know, I'm not saying NHS is like, it's the NHS, it's the brand everybody knows. Mm-hmm. What's your take on how do you manage these conversations where there's a lot more at stake?
Yeah. And we've had these as well before, to be fair. When we were building the agency, year 4 or 5, I can remember our biggest client at the time was about 20% of our revenue, and probably 9 or 10 of the staff were running ragged every month. We were doubling the hours. It was really, really difficult. And when it came up to renewal, we quoted them double. And they said, well, we're going to have to RFP this out. You know, this isn't where we want it to be. And we said, well, it's okay, because we just can't run at this level anymore. And you know, the team members are getting burnt out. It's not going to work. You know, they're our strongest members. So I think you still got to be willing to make that call. And it's hard. You can always keep the brand as a previous client, right? But 20% drop is going to hurt anybody. So I think what you have to do before you just make that decision, is start putting some plans in place to try and, you know, alleviate some of that that pressure that's going to.
So basically, the more BATNA, which is a negotiation term, best alternative to negotiated agreement, the more cushion you have, the more you kind of like, hey, I'm Luke. I'm, you know, I make Skywalker look like he's got some self-esteem issues. Like, I can do whatever. I could lead this through. I could take on this challenge, right? Like, it could be mental preparedness. It could be, you know, contingency plans in terms of business. But you want to basically have that optionality so that you're not at a mercy of something that you have to do that's fundamentally suboptimal.
100%. And I also think in a revenue, like kind of retainer-based service model that an agent is, ideally, you don't really want clients that are more than 10 or 15% of revenues in a single client. It's just too much risk. Whenever we got above that, we always tried to work to pull it back and get other clients to pull it back in line. So, you know, you're always, I think in an agency business, you're a phone call away from success or failure at any one time. But if you stack too many eggs in one client, you know, it's too risky. So, yeah, I think, you know, diversify as much as possible.
Got it. So back to digital experience. So imagine you're doing a pitch, right? And there's a maybe life component sometimes, right? But sometimes it's an RFP, like you said, and you have to submit it.
Yeah.
So what's your dream case scenario for standing out in that environment? You know, if you start, you're building a new agency from scratch, right? You want to equip yourself to crank these out efficiently, crank them out in a way that they feel like they lead to this authentic relationship and stand out, right? And help you get an edge in the competition.
Standing out's the key, isn't it? And I think, you know, there's ways that you can do that to punch above your weight. You know, typically what most agencies are still doing is submitting a PDF document and just sending it over. So if there's a way, here's a plug for Relay2, but it is true. You know, it is true. If you can visualize that in a better format, or you can put it across in a way that's going to actually stand out over and above the crowd. If they're getting 10 proposals and one comes across as like a mini site and it's beautiful and it's organized and it's different, that just gives you a slight edge, I think. And you know, Relay2
and slight edge matters, right? Like slight edge in these competitive bids, because you don't know, they're pretty, these things are tight, right? Like, unless it's like an established relationship and all the other people are there just to kind of, you know, push you a little bit on price.
Yeah.
If it's a genuine competition, it's not like you rarely get this 80-20 likelihood outcomes. It's like 55-45 at best, right?
Yeah, and it's commoditized again, right? So everyone's selling the same service. They might have a slightly different price. They might have a different narrative, but effectively it's the same thing. You're selling SEO, PPC, social, whatever it is. So, yeah.
This is interesting. We noticed this across not just like marketing agencies, but any agencies, like in US, like in employee benefits, brokers are effectively agencies that deliver similar services. And one of the services relates to employee communications around their benefits and healthcare plans. And what was interesting to us is, we just assume, well, look, this doesn't have to be super, like, it's like whatever the people are doing is not like the top end of creativity. It's not like what, you know, it's not Nike type of, you know, doing their kind of some brand pitch, but actually small things about something that matters in an industry that has some commodity pressures, they matter a whole lot than small, right? It's a difference between getting a client or keeping a client, and losing, you know, substantial amount of commission in that kind of part of world, very similar. So it was surprising to me that it's doesn't have to be, the industry doesn't have to be sexy, Mad Men, you know, Luke the Ogilvy Tobin, you know, it could be an industry we don't typically associate with wild communication requirements like employee benefits, but it actually is a big differentiator there. Is that what you've seen for some of your clients as well, that are dealing with these commodity pressures?
Absolutely. I think any business that's in a highly competitive or commodity type space, every single point difference that you can make is critical, right? And if you can do that, leveraging technology, leveraging design tweaks, support, whatever it is, it makes a massive impact. So yeah, I mean, I've seen it time and time again, even with our own pitching, by leveraging tech and trying to do things to stand out makes a massive impact. And all the big companies out there, all the we touched on Samsung and Unilever and those guys, they're all constantly looking for ways to elevate themselves. So if you're a smaller business or a mid-tier business, you absolutely have to, because otherwise, you've got to follow the leaders and people that are setting the standard. So
So you're
yeah.
saying the leaders are not standing still either. It's not
They're
one of
not.
those things that like, oh, I'm asleep at the wheel. So you feel like, because they're getting pitched a lot, they get creative ideas, so
Exactly.
they're getting there. So if you're not congruent and
Yeah.
you show up and you say Samsung, we're world's most creative agency for performance marketing, and then you're not creative at all in terms of how you look and
Exactly.
feel and your first impressions, which tend to be digital quite a lot of times, for at least for some people, right? Not
Yeah,
everybody, but
sure.
like typically the senior decision maker that signs off and scans the proposal does not go have a lot of initial debrief meetings with you, right? Like you get like one chance to get that CMO, CEO to say, oh yeah, I like these guys, right? Like this feels aligned with my vision. And it's a very intuitive decision oftentimes as well.
Definitely.
And then you if you miss that chance, you're sort of all that work.
Yeah, it stands out. One of the things we did actually a lot of the agency is we would rebrand our pitches to the client that we were pitching, so to their brand, and effectively then just have a very subtle mention of our own logo, but it would be all about them, right? It's all about fixing their challenges, their problems, but presenting that in a way that maybe they haven't thought to present their own pitch. Or their own, that again stands out to them, and it will just resonate. So it's just coming at it a slightly different way. A lot of people that are presenting, they present it's all about them and their design.
Me, 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 me. Look at
Yeah.
me. I have this many people in my company. We have offices here, we're there.
Exactly.
It's
That's
like,
not the point.
yuck.
Not the point.
Unless you are like maybe like there are some brands like Ogilvy or whatever that are sort of have a maybe an unfair advantage. It's not obvious, right? But because they could appear arrogant. But so that's interesting insight. We noticed that something similar started to happen where for strategic pitches, people would, on the cover pages, as you know, in Relate, you could add a video and the AI kind of the background fills it in. So on the you would write your deck, and then people would take a little B-roll of a video from some corporate video that the client has put out, and roll that underneath, and so you basically. People were like, hey, we're Sony, and we're like looking at some Sony studio content, and we feel good. And it's sort of like, it feels like it's definitely done for us. It's a small touch, t tiny touch, right? It has very little to do with what's like on page 54 in the pricing, which is where, but it moves you out of a analytical, cerebral, skeptical mode as a client into somebody who's like, okay, well, at least they put in an effort, they care enough to feel like they're aligned, which just sounds like your vision. And then I think separately, there's something that generates excitement, right? Like very often, like some people, some content, you'd be like, oh, I'm really looking forward to reading your proposal, but I'd say that's minority. I don't know what it's been your experience. You don't like people don't wake up in the morning. It's like, I want to look at a 54 page PDF on my screen. Like that. But then you see this video and it's exciting and it feels like it's tuned. And it's like, oh, something happens emotionally. We're not conscious what it is. Have you seen things like that work in pitches as well in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, look, people's attention span is minute these days, right? We're all so used to like instant gratification, being able to watch things on social media or whatever and get an instant feeling for what the core message is. And I think the beauty of being able to digitize like a sales process into a truly digital form is that if they don't want to read all the gumph and they want to just go straight to the pricing page, just click to that section. Or, you know, having an embedded video just allows you to control the narrative. What we used to do actually kind of early on with pictures in COVID, where we couldn't always get in front of people, is we'd send a Loom video, you know, on a basic level, very basic level, along with it. And actually early on that really worked. And then obviously everyone's kind of...
Everyone did it,
Everyone did it. But to begin with, it really worked. And I think this kind of, the more digitally integrated your pitch and sales process can be, the easier it is for a client to find exactly what they need. And if they're scanning and they're trying to make a decision, they might already be brought in from the pitch, but they're going back in the deck to have a look for something specific. If you can kind of index that out and make them just click to that section, and the video just talks them through it in 2 minutes, it just makes life easy. And again, much easier than 9 out of the 10 pitches they will have received, which they've got to scroll through all the pages and try and, you know, so yeah, simplifying is critical.
So you kind of send something that's different, something that's simpler, which is an indication that, hey, we're organized. We're easy to work with, right? You can say that in your pitch. And then if you show up with like something that's really not intuitive and a lot of work to get to the things you need, that's, again, that's incongruent. And somebody that is more congruent, more connected with their message, it says it louder than any words. Like, hey, we, you know, especially if you have a complex pitch, I would imagine, like, it's harder to find that balance. But that's exactly when it matters. Like, hey, trust us with your full flow, because we're really well organized. And we're going to, and here's this proposal. And it's, it without saying anything, it shows that, hey, we're very well organized and easy to work with.
Exactly.
And so you can trust us. And this is back to that thing about trust. I think we often think that trust is, sometimes it's time, right? But sometimes it's just being congruent is just as important as time. You could build a lot of, you could spend a lot of time with somebody and like come across like a douchebag because you just, you're not congruent. You're not thinking through and or not following through on the commitments and or just as discontinuity.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's critical.
So when we mentioned trust, and we said like there's some specific things about UK and the origins are in UK, but what's remarkable is that you actually when we met at first, you told me about your expansion across Europe and beyond. Tell me a little bit about that, and how did you manage that? What were particular challenges spreading when you can't be that, you know, in all these new markets all the time, and that there's on top of it the cultural challenge?
It was definitely fraught with challenges and road bumps. In 2021, I was a bit of a sucker for punishment. Actually, we did 2 acquisitions in the UK. We launched in Germany and we launched in Canada, so all in 1 year. So the momentum was in the sales, and I thought, well, you've got to ride it whilst the momentum's there. So it was an incredible experience, but I think in hindsight I probably needed 2 or 3 of me to do a really thorough job of it. We launched in Germany quite opportunistically, really. There was a content agency there that needed support, and they had a lot of UK clients, and we kind of managed to tee up. And in the end, that was fairly successful. You know, I think we signed 15 or so clients in our first year, few less in the second year, because trying to get the sales process right and the language piece was a challenge. But generally, it was a successful launch. Canada was easier. Because we started just with a couple of salespeople on the ground there. I went over and spent 2 months in Toronto, door knocking, doing everything back to like kind of grassroots, like sales tactics. And it worked really well. You know, we signed 30 or so clients in the first 6 months. And we had a good agency just in Toronto, which was awesome. I think the challenge then with sustaining all of that level of growth at the same time is you've got this kind of seesaw effect internally, right? So if you focus on sales too much, stuff starts falling out in the operations, and you focus on operations too much, your sales fall out. So trying to get that balance right was always the challenge. But it was all about getting the right senior leadership in place. So I spent a lot of time recruiting and hiring, and luckily a couple of the acquisitions I did brought a couple of team members in that were quite strong for the senior leadership team. Did a lot of cherry picking of competitor staff that, you know, I thought stood out to me in the market and I'd come across and had some experience with. So we kind of battled through that, but it was, yeah, it was fraught with challenges and road bumps, and you know, but we pulled it off.
What do you account for your success, in particularly in Canada? Is it just, you know, the market was not as competitive? Is it that you treated it like it was another startup and you kind of became like Toronto native? And what was that all about? Ubuntu. What was that all about? to use my stereotypical Canadian phrase.
That's so good. I've actually got a Canadian mug somewhere. It says AI. I think the thing that stood out was, you know, we came out the back of COVID. It was 21, 22, 22 really, that I was in Canada for those few months. And we were door knocking again. And we were like phone bashing. And we were like doing all this like kind of cold calling stuff that I think for a couple of years had been rested. I think that actually really played in our benefit. And also, you know, Canadians are generally quite nice. So when you call them, they're up for a 5-minute chat, or, you know, there was a few exceptions to that rule, but generally we were able to talk to them. Arguably, I think the English
accent. Not the Canadians of the Ukrainian descent, man. I have to tell you, that's a tough bunch, but you must have avoided those.
I definitely avoided those somehow. But yeah, no, it just seemed to gel.
By the way, for those that are listening, my last name is Shevelenko, and I was born in Ukraine, so I get a right to Soviet Ukraine. I get a right to beat that up a little bit. But yeah, so they were more open, that it sounds like, to somebody coming in from a cold.
Exactly. We were pitching at prices as well, which was still good margin for us, kind of UK type rates converted into dollars, which arguably was cheap for the market. So I think that also really helped. So we were still happy with what we were making, but the typical agency based out of North America was charging, you know, at least a third, if not, you know, up to double the cost. So, you know, I think that competitive piece was quite good. There was also the piece that we talked to a lot of the targeting we did was around companies that wanted to internationalize into Europe. And I think this gave us a really nice sweet spot of, hey, we've got a dot on each side of the pond, and we can help kind of, you know, get you set up in the UK and into Europe. And most North Americans, as you know, North American businesses want to launch into Ireland and UK first, and then they springboard into Europe because of the language. So it was a really nice, compelling message to be like, hey, we'll help you jump over the pond, and then we'll help you into Europe. So that worked pretty well.
Got it. So how do you, kind of coming back to this international theme, so most UK companies, right, and you had a few UK smaller clients that needed to have presence in North America, right? And how do you support them in a world-class way when you're yourself, you know, even pre-Canada, right, like not physically in New York, in San Fran? What did you find to be your kind of levers of succeeding there? Was it possible, difficult? You know, was it easier to do the European play or pan-European play versus the North American global play?
We definitely did a lot more helping, I think, North American businesses in Europe than we did the other way around.
Interesting.
Okay. I think maybe that's because, one, they had the budgets and they wanted to be aggressive, and they were looking for agencies that understood both sides of the market, because we were running a lot of campaigns still in North America. But I was also very willing to work with US-based and North American-based contractors to support and kind of get that leverage. So we had 3 or 4 contractors dotted around, depending on, you know, one was in the Midwest, one was on the West Coast, one a couple on the East Coast. And that just gave us a bit of capacity, I guess, in country, and access to media buying and some of the networks that we probably didn't have that natural connection with. Over time, we started to build a good database, and it was easier to deploy some of that from the UK, but it does come with natural challenges. I mean, the agencies that do this really well do what we did in the end and put a dot on the map and actually start staffing up over in North America, because it is very hard to do. And also our kind of experience with, you know, US businesses specifically liked to have US natives and people that were local to them working on the account. They didn't mind that some of the delivery was done in the UK. There was something quite novel about that, I think, but they wanted to have a US entity or a North American entity, and there was kind of that trust factor element. So we kind of navigated that, I think, quite well by having contractors and building out more of a global network than anything else. In the end, we had a network of contractors across about 11 markets. So that really helped us. So we didn't need to have dedicated staff because we were able to kind of dial up or dial down depending on the demands of the clients.
Got it. Now, let's fast forward a little bit to your current hat as an investor. How do you look at the marketing component of some of your portfolio? Are you actually evaluating are you including their marketing savviness or not, right, into the investment strategy? And you could say, hey, if these guys are marketing like shit or not marketing at all and they're getting these results, this is great, this is a great opportunity. Or you could say, hey, these guys have, you know, they're tuned on, they're executing because I have this deep expertise in you know, 5 minutes from my looking at their SEO strategy and scores, and I could see that at least that the go-to-market machine is on. Like, to guide me a little bit on, you know, is this an important consideration compared to other areas?
It definitely plays a part. And I think, you know, I've done investments where it's just capital deployment. And typically, to be comfortable to do that and not have any kind of advisory sway or support element, I definitely look at their marketing component and understand their go-to-market and try to get as detailed as possible. So if that looks strong and actually, you know, they've got a good team and they're executing, like, hey, cool, I would be more comfortable at that point just putting a bit of capital in and being passive. On the ones where I see opportunity for, you know, enhancement of those strategies, typically I will do investment plus advisory or some sort of packaged approach. So, you know, a bit of capital on the table, a bit of equity for services, something like that, because it benefits both sides. But also I just know that with small tweaks and enhancements, it will, you know, it'll work for everybody's benefit. So yeah, it's two-sided when it comes to that, but I'm always evaluating whether I think they've got a strong go-to-market, definitely.
So since you brought that up, so we have a pretty unusual relationship. You've invested in Relate2, and you're continuing to advise us, and you're bringing in some folks that you know and work with to help us out. And it, you know, we're thrilled about this. I would be curious to hear unfiltered take on what was going on through your mind when you first kind of learned about what we're doing, and then started looking. And that, like, you know, hey, you have a lot of opportunities. Why do you decide to allocate both your time and your money towards helping an upstart like us?
No, awesome. I mean, first of all, Alex, you know, we had, you know, that meet and chat, and I think we were kind of glued to each other for an hour or two chatting and really brought into the vision. I think you've got a great vision for where you want Relate2 to be. And I, you know, I really bought into that, and then, you know, went and played with the platform. I was like, actually, you know, this tech is cool. It's pretty sexy. It works well, like, it's easy. And I test a lot of tech solutions that just aren't actually as simple and easy to use. So that was great.
So I didn't oversell the tech. Is that, is this is like,
actually, no, you didn't.
That's good.
I think really, if anything, you underplayed the tech. You were talking more about the vision of where you want to be. And I think that's a founder, that's always in a founder, right? To talk right. about, hey, there's problems today. We want to be here. Yeah. And nothing's ever perfect, which is great. But no, I was pleasantly surprised when I got hold of the tech and started messing around. And I've been using it actually as a kind of, you know, a customer in a sense. You know, I've been using it when I'm going out and doing pitches now and presentations. I did a training workshop using Relate2 the other day. So genuinely, you know, it has been excellent for me. But I think, you know, from a investment advisory point of view, what I liked was you're still at this kind of early stage in the platform journey and taking it to market, trying to find the right fit for the ICPs. And I do realize that, like, I think there's a lot of businesses that will benefit from Relate2, but I think there's just ways that we can tweak the go-to-market to make it accelerate a lot faster. And I saw the opportunity there to add some benefit support. I knew we'd work well together. And I can see that the future and the opportunity is good. So
that's you politely, in a very British way, just pointed out that for marketing, oriented company. I would say we're not only for marketing because we support sales and broader comms, but you know, marketers get it really quickly, but we have done very little marketing. And that's good in the sense that let the product do the work, and like let's because you hate these products that are really well marketed, but then you go, what's there afterwards? But I think that's also exciting that there is like it is early days, and the future is still ahead. And I think companies need to find things like I don't know what your take is, but I think there's a lot of talk about the product market fit.
Mm-hmm.
But also there is like a kind of distribution and go-to-market kind of fit to that for that product, right? And then so I think it's not just about is the product great, is like, is this distribution channel going to be delivering disproportionate results and getting you those kind of great customers? And that is not an obvious one, right? Like, as we discussed, like you almost have to do base overall playbook, and you have to then find your equivalent of what's the PayPal, you know, PayPal finding eBay as their perfect distribution strategy, that version, right, of the like rapidly moving water. What's your take on the kind of those challenges in a resource constrained environment where you can't easily try everything, but you still need to play well enough in multiple areas?
You do. And I spend a lot of time talking to founders and tech founders, and I think there's an obsession, and I understand why, around the products and getting like the best possible product ready and built and to market. But actually, that kind of like, how do we scale and sell this piece often gets kind of like, well, if we have a great product, it will obviously just sell. And it'll obviously just fly off the shelves. Yeah. And it's like, well, not in today's world. No, that go to market and that kind of that way of positioning yourself and understanding like who the end user is so much more, almost arguably more important. The product piece, if you've got a good idea, you can almost backfill the product, right? It's how you're going to sell it and enable it. You know, new revenue fixes all problems. So how can we get the revenue flowing to keep the scale? So yeah, no, for me, I think it is often underlooked at. And actually that's an area that I love to work in, because I think I can try and add some extra padding to what's probably a good product there, or certainly conceptually a good product, and then work out how we can actually go out and sell it, which is, you know, the key. And that's the beauty.
Yeah, there's a saying that I like, that first time founders care about the product and second time founders care about distribution.
Yeah.
And it is a seesaw, right? Because if you totally get the distribution and then the product is not particularly differentiated and not mm-hmm. sustainable, like somebody will go and steal your distribution play, you know, eventually. So it's not like it's not super simple mm-hmm. like that, right? Like you need to build something, especially we're working a lot in AI, and so it's very fortunate that we were an agency and put a lot of our workflows as an agency, which mm-hmm. are just impossible to copy for somebody who has not gone deep enough in the mm-hmm. domain to understand like what does a human do and kind of how do you tweak that algorithmically for AI, for a number of tools. But that's time consuming, but it still doesn't, like you said, it still doesn't solve the distribution thing. And in fact, if you don't test the distribution at the same time, maybe you build like an amazing, amazing product that just is very inefficient to distribute.
I think that's actually a really good point, Alex, because you built this almost for yourselves, right? And actually that is the product market fit, right? You built it for yourselves as like, you know, to be able to internally use.
Yeah.
And then we're like, actually,
I mean, it was the problem that you were outlining, is like, hey, some of our customers, like, hey, I love your vision, your decks. This is all great thinking. Like, how does this stand out? How do we deliver it, you know, in a way that helps us actually helps this idea get from the deck to the customer's head mm-hmm. and get from their head into their hands and actions and behaviors? And that was like, you know, a big enough problem, fortunately, right? But you were saying something similar, like in terms of the challenges that you saw. So you could relate, I guess. But okay. back to sorry, I interrupted your flow.
No, all good. Yeah, no, I feel like that is the perfect, you have this perfect use case because you tested it. But I think the key is being able to look at, obviously you need to build a good product, but being able to look at like what is that actual strategy for distribution and growth, and like how does that come together and fit in, and identifying that ICP early and actually then getting some buy-in is critical.
Well, and I think one of the things that I'm curious about your views and surprises in marketing and as you go to market. So we had the ICP that I had in mind looked a lot more similar to myself and kind of the challenges that I faced. But I certainly did not predict the employee benefit broker in the U.S. is going to be like, hey, this is amazing for this and reason. I'm ripping out these other tools that are kind of 20 years old that I've been using, and I had no idea, even though I was sort of come from SuccessFactors in the world of HR tech. I didn't see it, and so that is maybe something that you would say is a interesting side benefit of doing a lot of experimentation, including on performance marketing. What have you seen that are some of the biggest surprises for your clients that you could talk about that come out of, you know, creative marketing?
Yeah, I mean, for us, you know, we always call it in performance like A/B testing, and then that leads into, you know, learnings and cross learnings and opportunities. But you know, I think finding those and identifying those different distribution channels, ICPs, whatever you want to call them, you can't. I think what we're talking about here is you can't plan for everything. So element of like, okay, look, you think you've got this perfect fit because it's something that, like in your case, solved your problems.
Yeah.
It's going to solve lookalike problems, which it does. But then also there's all these segues and opportunities that open up by when you go out and you start testing it. So I think really what we're talking about here is you can prepare, but you can't over prepare, and you need to be willing to kind of leverage and learn as you go. And I think the beauty of marketing is it gives you a fairly inexpensive way of testing some of that feedback if you do it right, and then obviously you can scale it up and you can push more budget into it and more demand.
Right, so I'm going to rework this. There's this famous quote: "Chance favors a prepared mind," but I think it's a combination of chance favors prepared mind and like a flexible stance.
Yeah,
you know, like when in sports, you're kind of if you. Then like a stick with like legs not bent, you're and the ball runs over there, you're gonna miss it. But if you're like this and you're positioned to pounce, and you're like easy on the move, you can grab at it. And it feels like this is something that that what you're describing is like you can probably have hypotheses, but you never know where the ball is gonna end up. So you better be in a position and agility to get to the ball. For the opportunity.
Definitely.
So we're moving into sports, and I think maybe let's tie into more holistic way of living at work. I think one of the things I admire about you in our conversation is just how well-rounded you approach building your career, defining what success looks like, and you've started a series pro bono of sharing these insights. Tell me a little bit more about that and how that kind of plays along with Tobin Capital and your general vision for life.
Yeah. I mean, I have to be honest, Alex, there's been times like in my career where I've hit burnout. I've lent too much into the career pillar, the archetypal, you know, what success is, chasing money, chasing whatever that brings. And over the last few years, and I think this is arguably what exits and success, you know, financial success gives you, is ability to reflect a bit more. So I appreciate maybe I'm coming at it from a position of privilege. However, even before the last exit, which was my largest one to date, I was thinking more and more about this kind of purpose piece and like who have I had around me that have inspired me and actually helped me? They might not have realized at the time they were helping me, but they have. And there's a few people, I think of just little conversations or times when I've been close to burnout and they've been able to help me. And I thought there is a model to success and there is a blueprint to success, but success isn't just wealth. and career, it's family, it's health, it's perception of life, which, you know, what is life if it's not how you see it? So I thought, well, how do I start taking some of these learnings? And I'm still on the journey a lot myself, but I'm trying to figure out, how do I start sharing this? So it started with a newsletter called The Success Method. I've been interviewing and talking to lots of different people that have been archetypally successful, other people that are successful, you know, maybe just in a different sense, you know, whether that be in their marriages, you know, families, health, trying to understand and unhack a little bit of like what makes these people successful in their own right. And I feed that through in the newsletter. We do a weekly issue. I started doing elements of kind of pro bono advisory and bits and bobs. And at the moment, you know, I'm really finding some kind of purpose in that, because I'm exploring and I'm figuring out things for myself. I'm getting as much from it probably as I'm giving out, which is great. And you know, I think it's kind of a constant learning journey together, and hopefully that kind of comes across in the newsletter. And then outside of that, I'm doing little bits of just some advisory and little bits of paid work whilst I figure out what comes next for me. You know, I exited the agency only at the end of last year. So it's early, you know, still taking, but again, position of privilege to be able to kind of just sit and think and figure that out. And I want to help other entrepreneurs and other founders on their journey whilst I'm doing that and share that process.
Well, I for one, anybody who's thinking about getting investment from you and advice from you, I'm a huge fan, and I think it is a privilege to get advice on these multiple levels, right? Like one level is like, hey, I've grown successful businesses, exited them, etc., scaled internationally. The other is deep expertise in your domain. Right, which is quite broad, because to run a modern marketing agency, you can't just be like super niche specialist. You have to be good at a number of disciplines, and integrating that is non-trivial. I think you could, if you find people that can bring it all together, hold on to them. That's a pretty rare gift. And then all at the same time, have this, you know, personal growth as a leader, as a human being, component. And that's something we connected at the beginning, and also recognizing that you know, success, like it's not necessarily defined as an exit only, right? Like it's you know, I even like the, like, I obviously work at a company called Success Factors that allowed the exit from which allowed me to pursue some entrepreneurial and other passions. But what I found interesting is that the word that I'm gravitating more towards is the word fulfillment. And I think you could run into issues into doing something, but you could still be deeply fulfilling, because it's aligned with your mission, but also the way you're wired, the way you're looking at it. If you have a growth mindset, you could look at the challenges and they could be seen as a source of motivation, and enjoying that the challenge becomes the destination and the journey and overcoming it. And that's, you know, that feels really congruent. And I know that's a lot of the thinking, and you know, we're, you know, not to nitpick on words, but that's a lot of the thinking behind what you're sharing. What's your take on that? You know, now that you know you also talk to other entrepreneurs, you know, what are the traps that people get caught on in the sort of their career journey, entrepreneurial journey, that, you know, you find are easily avoidable?
I think I'm not sure any of them are easily avoidable, but maybe with the right approach.
Or at least you should be aware of, like, let's just say, like, awareness, like, is awareness is the beginning, right? Like, awareness is the beginning. Like, where are people? Like, I'm going to exit and everything is going to be great. Yeah. I'm going to meet the girl of my life or the boy of my life, or, you know, whatever, the person, trans neutral person, neutral gender person of my life, and everything is going to be great. These are sort of like the narratives that society feeds us.
Yes.
And, you know, we, having had exits, right, we know that that's not okay. That's just going to be like, raises more questions than gives you more answers.
It does. It definitely raises more questions. I think the key with all of this is, you know, it the expectation that's set in us from a young age, I think, is, you know, work hard, chase the dream. Like if you're entrepreneurial, you go, okay, well, I want to build to sale. If I sell, I get all this money. If I get money, I can do whatever I want. It gives me, I think the freedom piece is important that comes with being able to exit business. But that purpose bit you alluded to is the bit that I don't think you really think about until you're there, because you forget, you're so busy trying to drive to this like goal. You forget sometimes to enjoy that journey. And the journey is the piece that matters the most, because when you get there, it's kind of like on a cliff, and all of a sudden you kind of come back down to earth and you go, oh, okay. So money can sit in a bank account, but it's not like I carry it on my person and I walk around and everyone goes, oh my God, look, you know, you're still the same person. And you, okay, yeah, you might have more, a bit more time, a bit more luxury, whatever, but you, if you still got stuff going on inside, you still got to deal with that stuff regardless. In fact, it might force you to deal with it a bit faster than you would have otherwise. So yeah, I think it's important to kind of, that people understand that the perception of archetypal success isn't actually all it's cracked up to be. I also think that there's a lot of pressure on people these days, and especially on younger generations, because social media, the expectation and that perception of like how other people are doing is, it's never good enough, right? So I, you know, I've had these exits, and I'm always going, oh, look at that guy. You know, he's gone and done three times the value, or 10 times it, you know, and you go, oh, you know, and you meet them and you go, sure, I could do that. Like, what's so, yeah, so
actually, they're human. They're human.
They're human. Like, you know, God, they're only 24 hours in a day as well. So it's always like, you're always reaching. And I think you've just got to find an ability to, and this is a lot of what this kind of success method is about. It's like, find an ability to be okay with being okay. But obviously, it doesn't mean take ambition out of the frame. It doesn't mean keep pushing, because I think we should.
This is the really the tricky part, right? Like, because it's like, try that out. I'm just going to meditate all day, right? Like, and just kind of be, you know, finding the joy from within. Maybe it works, actually. Maybe for some people, this is their wiring, and they just don't need something like that. And then for others, like, they're wired to grow. They need challenges to thrive. And it doesn't mean that you need to be disconnected.
No.
To have these, right? You know, I'll share just to make this a little bit more human as we wrap up. I'll share my kind of maybe three stories are coming tonight really, really quick. And maybe you could share yours as well, of these sort of realizations. So I remember one was, you know, kind of accidental exit of something I worked on, you know, before Stanford, during Stanford. And you know, we had exited, and I had like a little bit of money, and I instead of getting a job like everyone, I went on a backpacking trip around the world, which is in UK pretty common, called the gap year. In my case, I was, you know, turning 30, and I've never, you know, having come from a background where you couldn't travel outside of Soviet Union, I was really excited to kind of go see the world. And I was having the time of my life, I thought, and like dreams come true, all those places, kind of reliving the story of Jules Verne, kind of around the world in whatever number of days, just you know, coming out with challenges. But eventually I felt like I was getting bored, and not like, and even if I volunteered and did some things here and there, and, you know, made this kind of conquer every fear type of thing, it was just eventually it just felt like, yeah, you know, not enough. And then I was like, very clear, like, I'm not ready to retire, like, because that I would just kind of go crazy on that, even with that much excitement. So that was one. Another, I think, some people, maybe they get a promotion, and I remember kind of eventually I joined a great company, Success Factors, as I mentioned. I got my promotion, you know, big boost in equity. I was very happy. Ended up being helpful for me in more ways than that original exit. But at the right after I got the promotion, which I was like aiming for, I was like, whew, is that it? Is that all that was there? And I felt almost more disappointed. And so I needed to start doing some work on that, or like understand what was behind it, why it wasn't the fulfillment. And then some people, lastly, like on a really human level, lots of people that are looking for their loved ones, they're looking for that perfect relationship. And I was like that. And, you know, when I found one, I was super happy. And now to all my friends that are not married or haven't had, you know, married but haven't had kids, I'm like, well, the work just begins, you know, what's what right afterwards? Because I think there's a lot more learning in these intimate relationships that are, you know, sometimes even more challenging than the work learning about who you are, how you react, what triggers you, and so on. And so these are kind of three stories of like exits, you know, more conventional like career success milestones and human milestones that felt like they're just, you know, a new journey, right? Mm-hmm. Right? Like that's not the destination. What are your examples where you kind of had to learn something, feeling like you've achieved it, but then you restart, that are personal, just to so people get to know the look behind the blueprint?
No, I love it. I mean, I left home very young. So I left home at like 16 and then kind of went to college and kind of carried on my route on my own. Lots of different reasons behind that. But I found very early on that I needed to be like a go-getter to like fend for myself. And, you know, that came with immense pressure. I did do a similar story to you. So I had my first exit when I was kind of 19, 20. I was, you know, fairly young. It was a bar hire hospitality business that basically I got a really cool concert lined up, and was, I'm going to show my age here, was like doing concerts with like Beverly Knight, Sugar Babes, Lamar, people like that. And basically was doing the bar units. And at the time, I remember when I won the contract, I kind of was on this pitch, sales pitch call. And they were like, do you have bar units? Do you have stock? Do you have what? I was like, yeah. Put the phone down. And I was like, shit, I need to go and get this stuff now. I don't have any of it. So I was ringing around, begging, stealing, borrowing. Set this business, did a really good job of it. 2 years in, our biggest competitor bought me out. And I was like, okay, cool. So six-figure exit. I was like, okay, awesome. I can have a bit of time now to kind of go traveling. So I did a similar thing to you. And I kind of reset, went to Australia, lived in Aus for a year, did a lot of backpacking, made some money there as well. And then did Asia for 6 months on the way back. And at the end of that, well, actually about a month in, you know, into Asia especially, I was kind of coming up with brainstorming loads of ideas. And I realized that, you know, a similar story to yours, I have to be doing something. My brain, if I went on a reflection week a week ago and I sat for a week and I came up with like 100 new business ideas, it's just how I am. Mm-hmm. So I came back, you know, got myself stuck into my next business, which is an experience day company selling anything from hot air balloons to paintballing to car racing. Online and offline. I had sales teams in Australia and UK. Amazing journey. Absolutely loved that business. You know, it was great fun. Quite challenging going through the financial crisis and all of that. And, you know, people not wanting to buy these types of luxury items. But we pulled through. We did well. And then I exited that to Virgin, which was amazing. So that was kind of the second exit at that point. But at the back of that, I was like, okay, what now? Like, I've had two completely different experiences. I felt really unfulfilled then because I'd enjoyed the ride with the experience of business so much, but I knew I didn't want to do it again. So at that point, I was like, okay, what do I do? I haven't done the archetypal career path yet. Let's step into it. Let's give it a go. So at that point, I stepped into working in different consultancies, agencies. That's where I got my first kind of eye in on the marketing side. And that led me in the end to obviously having the marketing business. But at each stage, and at each point, I felt like I hadn't done enough and that I needed to chase something else. And I tried to take those moments to reset, but always found myself wanting to kind of jump back in and do something else. And the thing that I've found that has kept me energized, I think, in that is that I've jumped to different industries and different focuses, and it's given me a lot of learning. But the bit you mentioned at the end there around kind of relationships as well, we talk about those pillars of life, relationships. Mm-hmm. Love is one of them. I think everybody has this kind of expectation, again, like Instagram expectation of love, that you're going to end up in a relationship, it's going to be lust forever, and it's going to be, you know, it takes just as much work, as you say, as building a business, and you know, that's part of the journey. So yeah, that was a kind of a whistle stop tour. I tried to go through it quickly, but little bits at each stage and at every point, I think it's okay to go, each of those have a mix of success and failure in there, but like each one of them is just part of that stepping stone and that ladder of learning about yourself, right? So yeah, and then this most recent one with the marketing agency, you know, joined South America's largest independent agency group, on a path to IPO, came with a whole plethora of new experiences and learnings and imposter syndrome and all that stuff. And then, you know, you do that, you complete that and you go, oh, okay, is that it? Again, you know, again, like each time it's like, is that it? And then what now? And I think just human beings, we're always always striving, aren't we, to have new experiences and to learn new things. And I think experience is the key word. And then it's about, again, just being okay with, you know, the changes and the trials and tribulations.
Brilliant, Luke. Well, so good to deep dive. I did not know that you've sold the business to Virgin. I kind of missed that part. And it was an experience business. So anybody who sells an experience business to Virgin is my hero, because I think they've kind of created a brand for great experiences. So all the more valuable to have you on our team and have these discussions. Thank you so much for sharing insights with our audience. If people want to dig into Luke's story or wisdom, again, backed by you, where can they find you?
Yeah, absolutely. LukeTobin.com or TobinCapital.com or .co.uk in order to connect on the investing side. But LukeTobin.com is probably the best place. And also LinkedIn and all the typical channels. Just search Luke Tobin and you'll find me.
Luke, so good to have you here.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relateto.com, R-E-L-Y-T-O.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relateto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.